Should clinicians routinely ask patients about firearm access? Find out about this and more in today's Peer Direct Medical News podcast. I'm your host, Senior VP Medical Director, Dr. Tim Wright, coming to you today from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Here are today's stories. Firearm injury remains a major public health issue in the United States. From 2019 to 2021, an estimated 7.5 million people became new firearm owners, three times higher than expected based on prior trends. At the same time, the belief that guns make homes safer has increased substantially, despite evidence that firearm access also carries significant risk. A recent article published in the New England Journal of Medicine highlights how routine, safety-focused conversations about firearms can help identify patients at risk and reduce harm, particularly in the context of suicide prevention, domestic violence, and unintentional injury. The recommended approach follows the 3 A's framework: ask, advise, and assist. Clinicians are encouraged to ask about firearm access when relevant to patients' risk profile, advise on safer storage practices such as locking firearms and storing ammunition separately, and assist by offering resources or referrals tailored to the patient's circumstances. These conversations can be integrated into a broader discussions about safety, similar to counseling on seatbelts, smoking, or fall prevention. Although firearm ownership is common, discussions about gun safety rarely occur in clinical settings. Normalizing these conversations can help address modifiable risk factors while maintaining patient trust and avoiding political framing. A free online, on-demand CME course entitled Preventing Firearm Injury: What Clinicians Can Do is available on New England Journal of Medicine website to support clinicians with practical guidance and communication strategies. In our next story, we learned that while weight management medications such as semaglutide and tirzepatide are highly effective for short-term weight loss, maintaining that weight loss after discontinuation remains a challenge. A recent systematic review and meta-analysis published in the British Medical Journal examined data from 37 studies involving more than 9,300 adults with overweight or obesity to assess what happens after the medications are stopped. On average, individuals regained weight at a rate of about 0.4 kilograms per month and returned to their baseline weight within approximately 1.5 to 1.7 years. Weight regain occurred more rapidly after medication use than after behavioral weight loss programs. Although lifestyle interventions such as diet, physical activity, and structure support slowed the rate of regain, they did not fully prevent it. These findings reinforce that obesity behaves like a chronic condition. GLP-1 therapies can be an effective tool, but long-term success depends on ongoing treatment planning and sustained behavioral support. Clinicians should prepare patients for the likelihood of weight regain and emphasize the importance of lifestyle strategies if medication is discontinued. And finally, external trigeminal nerve stimulation, or TNS, received FDA clearance in 2019 as a non-pharmacologic treatment for pediatric ADHD based on a small pilot study. A larger, more rigorous, multi-centered, randomized clinical control trial published in Nature Medicine evaluated the device in 150 children and adolescents with ADHD using double-blind sham-controlled design. Participants used active or sham TNS nightly for 4 weeks, with follow-up extending to 6 months. Both groups showed improvement in ADHD symptoms, but there was no meaningful difference between active and sham treatment on the primary outcome measures. The findings suggest that symptom improvements were likely driven by placebo effect rather than true therapeutic benefit from the device. TNS was well tolerated with no serious adverse events reported. These results challenge the evidence base that supported FDA clearance and highlight the importance of rigorous sham controls when evaluating device-based intervention. Clinicians should be cautious when recommending neurostimulation devices for ADHD and continue to rely on treatments with proven clinical efficacy. And that's today's medical news. Thank you for joining us this episode of Peer Direct Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to Sean Mullen, Norm Dion, and Bryce Sadie for production assistance. Join me next time for an episode where we'll cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.